creative journey. It's easy to get lost, but don't worry, you'll lift off. Sometimes you just need a creative pep talk.
Hey, you're listening to Creative Pep Talk, a weekly podcast companion for your creative journey. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. I'm a New York Times bestselling author and illustrator. And whether I'm illustrating for clients like Apple or Xbox or pep talking creatives at places like Warby Parker or Sesame Street, I aim to make work and stories that inspire people to say yes to life, because I don't know about you, but it's easy to fall into the zone of just refusing and saying no to life. And I also have ADHD, which means it just takes a lot of creativity to do anything. And so this show is just me sharing the tips and tricks around creativity that help me do that in my life and in my creative practice. And I hope that it helps you do that too. If your next season is looking busier than the last, take something off your plate by putting Factor Meals onto your plate. Eliminating extra decisions can free up brain power for other things like self-care and creativity, and Factor Meals makes eating well streamlined with always fresh, never frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready in just 2 minutes. They have a weekly menu of over 35 options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week like breakfast, on-the-go, lunches, snacks, and beverages. I like their little vitamin-y shots. They're tasty. I like the spicy one. Head to factormeals.com/peptalk50 and use code peptalk50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code peptalk50 at factormeals.com/peptalk50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it. Got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site anyway. Go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. I don't know about you, but when I was starting as a creator, when I went to school for illustration and design, or even when I got out, I always felt this pressure and impulse to make my work more personal. I always longed to make the kind of creative work that made people feel something, that when you had an encounter with it, it really moved you on a deep level. But I didn't know how to do that at all. And even the people that were around me that were kind of encouraging me to go a step further in my work in terms of making it personal or have more rich metaphors or symbols, I don't feel like they were handing me tools on how to do it. It just seemed like this very abstract concept, like find yourself.
Find yourself.
And I often joke that I went to school and was like, hey, I need to find my style. And my teacher was kind of like, find your style. Your style finds you if you're lucky. And that kind of, you know, abstract approach to the creative journey was just not useful. And so I became obsessed with finding tools that and exercises that were clear, that maybe didn't work every time or weren't magic, but if you put in the time, eventually you would kind of unearth some of the magic within you. And this episode is a conversation that I had with podcaster Michael Phillip, who has a podcast called Third Eye Drops. This was him interviewing me on his show, and it was such a great conversation that I really wanted to share it here. We talk about a lot of things that we don't talk about on the show regularly. Michael's show is a little bit more spiritual leaning, cosmic energy leaning. And I think he approaches it in a really fun, lighthearted way. I don't know Michael super well, but I had already checked out his podcast before and loved his episode with Lisa Miller, who is a PhD, who wrote the book Awakened Brain. Highly recommend that book if you would like to incorporate some kind of spirituality in your life, but traditional religion really puts you off. She is doing brilliant work at Columbia, and just that book just totally changed my life. And loved his interview with her, loved his solo episodes on Carl Jung. And this conversation was so cathartic for me because I got to talk in depth about some of the things that I've only touched upon on this podcast, Creative Pep Talk, in the past. And so we dive into a lot of things that have helped me make work that feels richer and more personal, practical things that I've done, as well as explore symbol and metaphor and analogy in a bunch of different angles, because not only did I not how to didn't know how to create those things when I was getting started, but I also didn't fully understand the appeal or how to inject that kind of power into your work. And I hope that as we really pull this apart and dissect it at kind of a micro level, that there might be some tips and tricks that help you do the same and help you find some of the enjoyment that I get from the work that I make now. So without further ado, here is my chat. Here is me being interviewed on Michael Phillips' podcast, Third Eye Drops. Hope you love it. Already heard a lot of great things from people that already listened to his show. And here it is.
Yeah, I was really interested when I saw the sort of combination of playfulness. Did I put a T in there somewhere? Playfulness. That combined with your interest in Jung has really piqued my interest. And I'm curious how that came into your method, into your curiosity, and into all the way on up to wanting to talk to me. I'm curious how all these things coalesced.
Well, hey man, I'm super pumped to be here. Like I said before we got on, I'm an illustrator. I talk to a lot of different artists and creators on my podcast, but I haven't really properly made the leap into worlds around psychology, philosophy, spirituality in any significant way other than personally. So I haven't really dove into those worlds via podcast conversations or in real life or whatever. And it's a huge part of my creative practice and kind of always has been. And so, you know, I've checked out your podcast a bunch of times. I love your kind of dives into archetypes and Jung and some of the conversations you have. Thanks. I loved your episode with Lisa Miller, Dr. Lisa Miller. Yeah. That was phenomenal. And I've been listening to one of your recent ones with Eric. And I'm just kind of pumped to talk about it from that angle because it's weird. I kind of got into Jung via Joseph Campbell. And that hero's journey into the hero's journey has been happening for probably a decade plus or something. I got really obsessed with story structure, myth. This sounds kind of like a joke, but I'm genuine when I say story is kind of how I think of my religion. Like, I just think that's kind of my guiding practice. And the further I got into Jungian, you know, philosophy and all the analysts and all that dream theories and interpretation, the more shocked I've been that it's not a bigger thing in the visual art world or in especially in illustration. Like, illustration more than any other practice is writing with pictures, which is kind of the definition of a symbol. And so I just feel like I've been over the past few years especially stumbled into this like treasure trove and then reverse engineering, like, oh, there's a bunch of ways that this has been working itself through my work since I got started as a creator. So all that to say, I'm pumped to finally talk to someone who has a maybe even a deeper understanding of this stuff and come at it from two different ways.
We'll see, man. We'll see. It's a weird little pod of thinkers that's, you know, it's weird because I'm not traditionally trained in any of this stuff. I, like you, have just been an enthusiast, and it has made things make so much more sense. And when you confront the titanic nature of Jung's intelligence and just how much he read, you know, I was just recording an intro earlier and I made the remark of, I just love when I stumble across these people who have that really deep technical empirical knowledge and they still refuse to orphan the subjective visionary phenomenological type of wisdom too, because they realize they're two parts of the non-dual coin. You know, they're both parts of what Jung would call the unus mundus or whatever.
Yeah.
And you really need to look at life and wisdom and sense making from both angles. And it's rare to find that. And Jung, I think, was probably the premier thinker in that kind of dual non-dual way of the 20th century for me at least, or very high up there. You know, obviously people like Campbell are up there too, but I'm with you, man. And just also with that desire to go back into the corpus of ancient wisdom and realize there's so much in there that we need, you know, we can't abandon the ancient Hellenistic and Greek lineages of wisdom. We can't abandon native sources of wisdom. We can't abandon Eastern wisdom. They all have something core to say, even now, to an illustrator like you and some, you know, dude sitting in his, you know, bedroom office, you know, almost 100, like, depending on what we're talking about, hundreds or thousands of years later. And
yeah.
So why do you think that is? Like, what is it to that speaks to you about it?
You know, a couple of things you said in there that I wanted to just pull out. One was his thinking being so vast that whenever you find someone who's kind of enamored with this thought, whether they're, you know, trained in it or just stumbled into it and became obsessed, I'm not someone who's threatened by other people's point of view. I'm just curious about it for the most part. And, that what you realize is, if someone's into Jungian thought, that can mean so many different things.
Right.
But I loved how I think what you were saying, or how I understood it, was I'm so attracted to this school of thought because it manages to be metaphysical and physical at the same time without, yes, like, he definitely had his years that were more out there than others. And but it all seemed to never, you know, he never, I feel like when you dive into spiritual thought or philosophical thought or however you want to slice it, you get a lot of people that end up wanting to pretend like we don't live in reality and, you right. know, want to adopt a lot of ideas. And I'm open. Like I like fun ideas too. I don't even have to believe them to yeah. have some fun with them. Like that's, I like that, but I think what resonates with me and why it's kind of risen to the top out of all the different things that I've explored as a human and as an artist is that it manages to have the essence of something that feels truly like transcendent and spiritual. Mm-hmm. You know, when you really hear a great interpretation of a dream or a myth or a story, you get a feeling that is not unlike yeah. what you get at a, you know, the most ideal transcendent experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yet there's no piece of you in that moment that's having to break off what you know to be true about just basic fundamental reality.
Right, right.
You're able to hold both at the same time. And it does that better than anything else. And then, you know, personally for my illustration practice, I went on a really, a classical kind of hero's journey where 10 years ago, I was an illustrator, working as a commercial illustrator with brands and that kind of thing, magazines and all that. And I really fell in love with story and I fell in love with public speaking and podcasting and all that kind of thing. And I really dove deep into it. And I had a season where I was still working as an illustrator, but I kind of had lost interest in, or the passion wasn't there. It was more just mm-hmm. becoming like a skill.
Yeah.
And then by the time I had my real deep dive into Jungian thought, it's kind of always been at the periphery. I've known, I've always liked Jungian stuff, but it wasn't until the past maybe 2 or 3 years that I really started to dive deeper into it. But when I did, and I stumbled into symbol and archetype and dream interpretation, all that kind of thing, I realized that the image and the symbol and the picture is where the power of a story comes to life.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I'm not saying that in a way that's like fanciful. I think it's very practical that when you have the right image to illustrate a point or a proof in a story, the point, the theme, the emotion and the power comes from that symbol. And I'll give you one really quick example because please, otherwise yeah. it's just really abstract. One of my favorite story experts is a guy named Brian McDonald. He wrote a book called Invisible Ink. And in that book, he talks through a lot of different stories that he's a big fan of. But one of the stories he dissects is Iron Giant, which is like a classic mm-hmm. movie and a really phenomenal story. And the moment where it clicked for me was I kind of took what he said and I pushed it a little into the Jungian world, and it had this profound effect on me. So he talked about how the point of that movie is you are who you choose to be. And the reason why they choose this robot as the symbol is a robot is the direct opposite of that. And right. so it's the thing that is engineered to be a particular thing. And in that movie, if it's engineered to be a war machine and then it chooses to be something that saves humanity, that's an illustration of you are who you choose to be. But then as I was listening to Jungian analysts interpret dreams over a long time, and I dove into the work, I found that when you found the language that works for both the illustration and the point you're trying to make, when you really line that up, it has, at least to me, this kind of chemical aha moment. It just has this feeling. And so he said, you are who you choose to be. And I thought, if you're trying to make it as an interpreter would take it, I think they would say, defy your programming. Mm. And it's that idea of defying your programming brings that symbol to light. And all of a sudden, the fact that you chose an illustration of a robot to talk about human programming and our own DNA and all that, the symbol, the metaphor, the picture has all of this power.
Yeah.
And then I came all the way home and just fell in love with illustration. So sorry, sorry for such a giant explanation, but that's kind of what happened.
I'm really glad you bring this up because you're evoking one of the richest archetypes that is mercurial and takes on so many forms and never leaves the zeitgeist. And that is, you know, what we could call the sort of Plato's cave allegory, the Gnostic matrix myth, you know, essentially this idea of fatalism versus free will, right? Or determinism versus free will. But where it gets so, where you get into such a fractal mind fuck is that both fatalism and free will are required to make some kind of cosmic order happen in a way that almost sounds paradoxical, but I think works in a compatibilist kind of way. And here's what I mean by that. So you may have heard me ramble, or you may have heard of the book Soul's Code, right?
Yeah.
Which is a book by James Hillman, post-Jungian thinker, very famous in his own right. And this book sold really well. And essentially, if I give you a very shallow boilerplate summary of this book, it would almost sound like I'm contradicting what you're saying, where there's a very heavy fate component to this book in saying that you come into this world with a unique pattern, and only you can live out this pattern, and only you can explore this pattern. And that you could think of as Jungian individuation, right? Like becoming the person only you can become with all of your eccentricities and unique flair. That's the point of your incarnation, if you will, is to become that unique thing, which in a way is fate. But I think that also requires us to go against the grain in the kind of society we live in, because this society doesn't reward you for living out your own unique fate. Like, this society doesn't reward you for individuating. It rewards you for fitting into a box, right? I'm sure, you know, we're of a similar age. So we grew up taking these career tests in school and, you know, having the like the soul eroding conversation of what do you want to be when you grow up and career aptitude tests and stuff. And man, did my soul wriggle against that kind of stuff from a young age. It's funny. I'm so programmed to say Jung because I've been berated in the comments for saying young that I almost just said Jung instead of young when I actually meant the word young there. But, so there's this weird, like compatibilistic thing. And then, you know, that gets into all the ancient Greek lore about what fate is. And I could go there, but I don't want to hijack the conversation in that direction yet. So how do you feel about that? Are you okay with taking this compatibilistic view of it? Or is there something that really in you that wants to maintain that grip on true free will?
No, I don't. First of all, it's a great question. It's a question I've thought about quite a bit, and I'm going to answer it, but I just want to quickly say that the Iron Giant point, what blows me away about that isn't the point they're making. It's more just how the illustration brings that point to life. And why choosing the robot to illustrate it is such a power. It just kind of highlights the power of a symbol. But I personally, in terms of you are who you choose to be, no, I don't really feel like that. I think I went down, I'm sure you probably did a similar thing at some point, you know, running around on the internet with ideas. You're going to get into that place where you're going to find those determinists, and you're going to get deep into existential dread of the very, very little ability that we have to choose anything.
Yeah.
I went down that. Actually, Lisa Miller was one of the people that helped me out of that a little bit.
What a medicine in human form she is.
100%. And I needed that. And I kind of always just feel like, improv and, one of my great, I'll talk as a creator since that's what I can speak to. One of my true norths is the way that they creatively make Curb Your Enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I don't know if you're familiar with like,
I love Curb. Yeah.
And do you know, like, have you heard before that they have like an outline of the plot, but they don't have a script. They know where it's going. They know, mm-hmm. like, these are the three acts that we have to get in. These are like the plot points.
Yeah.
But they don't, when they start a scene, they know, like, by the end of the scene, Cheryl has to be mad at Larry for this thing, but they don't script it. And I think to me, that's kind of the perfect balance of plotter versus pantser, improv versus, you know, outline. Mm-hmm. And I kind of relate that. I think that's kind of how I've conceptualized our relationship to fate or God or whatever is, you know, I can't imagine a good reason to create a somewhat conscious being with some kind of agency without the point being letting them have some authorship.
Right. You know, like, right.
And so to me, I think it's, there's a collaborative yes and kind of thing between life, your code, what you're, and then what kind of happens. Cause I also am really struck by how, you know, I kind of feel like the deep self can't fully see the world as it is. It's almost like I've thought a lot about as I've navigated, you know, my podcast a lot about creative practice. It used to be even more about creative career kind of navigating. And I just kind of wanted to, creative practice leans towards the creative side rather than the career side. But one of the things I've really embraced is this idea that in the same way that a nighttime dream is kind of nonsense unless you interpret it, a daydream is nonsense unless you interpret it. It's that same, like, you have this deep self impulse when you're a kid to be like, I've thought about it like this. Like, if you dream, oh, I want to be an astronaut. Like, yeah, that might be true, but, or it could be that that was an archetype or a symbol of escaping your toxic atmosphere that you felt like you were in, or shooting for the stars or, you know, whatever. So that's kind of, I don't know if that answers that question, but that's kind of how I think of the fate versus choice thing, especially in navigating your path.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even if you don't believe in anything metaphysically, we're clearly not this open-ended being completely. I mean, you inherit genetics, epigenetics, blah, 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 you know, where you're born, what your income level of your parents was, all this stuff, all of it bears enormously on what you're capable of. And then to your point, you can get down the super reductionist, materialist rabbit hole of you have no free will. You're literally just a result of atoms colliding and physical laws and everything in your brain is predetermined and you're the victim of all, you know, all of these things essentially.
Just a big domino set, essentially, is that line of thought in it.
Yeah. And I just don't get down with that because even if you could predict my actions 99 times out of 100, that some people would say right there, look, we've proven you don't have free will, but I still have that one choice. You know, I still have that one choice, and that could be a significant choice. Cause what if that choice leads to meeting a person? What if that choice leads to moving? What if that choice leads to having an idea? I just don't buy that you can contain it in these physical boundaries like that. I think that it's too stochastic. It's, and plus, of course, I do side with you on being highly suspicious that there is this realm of psyche, realm of consciousness, realm of something else-ness that is not measurable with empirical tools. At the very least, I think there's probably also like a third thing, which again, I won't like start reaching for at this point in the conversation because I want to stick to where you're going.
We need to go there later though. Don't forget about that. Cause now I'm peaked and I'm sure people listening are as well. So I definitely want to return to that.
Yeah. It may be something if you mentioned that, like one of the pods I did recently. So it may be something you've heard about. But what I wanted to ask is, or what I wanted to say is that I agree with you in terms of how I sort of square the circle in those two things, seeming like, how can you have both free will and determinism? And it's sort of like, I guess the analogy I use is like open world RPG, right?
Yeah.
You make a character. The character has stats. The character has a skill tree. The character has a certain storyline that they have to go through, but it's tons of open-endedness within that. Maybe there's like a moral component. Maybe there's a, you know, depending on what kind of game it is, maybe there's like a romantic component, maybe whatever. Mm-hmm. And it seems similar. But man, then it's crazy, because amongst all these ancient thinkers too, you start to get this anti-fatalistic streak who think that whatever your fate is actually trapping you. That's what's trapping you in the Matrix. So man, it's just, you get into such like a weird metaphysical kerfuffle with all of the stuff that can really mess up your brain, whether you're listening to the Platonists or the Gnostics or the Jungians or the, you know, the Hermeticists. They all have like similar, but like slightly different tweaks on all of these things. And they're so thought provoking. And I go down various rabbit holes at various times, but it's just, I'm left okay in the gray area for the most part. But I am curious, because you brought up now that, of course, your creative habit is also your professional necessity.
Yeah.
So it sounds like at a certain point, you made a point of bringing back the open-ended creative expression in light of things like Jungian archetypes and the collective unconscious and psyche and symbol and mythopoetic more lenses. Tell me what that is like and how you exercise that.
Yeah. There's so many good threads, and I loved your, I love the open RPG. Like, I feel like that really unlocked a thing in my head, because as I've played a lot of those kind of games. I beat Elden Ring recently.
Me too. Yep. Yeah, it's great.
And
what class did you play?
What is it called? Oh man, it's been like
I was a samurai. Months.
Samurai. Yeah, I've heard it's a good one.
I started with a more magic heavy class, and I got bored running around and shooting stuff all the time. Like, I want to just get in there and just. Anyway.
I usually I tend to go for the magic ones. And then this time I've gotten really into like the combat side of these games. And I thought, I want to go on. So I'm one of the fighting ones that I can't remember what the word is. It's been too long. It's been 6 months and I've been playing Zelda and all kinds of other stuff. So, but I love that. I think that's perfect. And then I just also think, if you can think of like an infinite hard drive computing power, then you also have the possibility of endless alternate endings too. And that kind of,
right.
I love it. But back to the illustration practice. Yeah. So I think that what ended up happening was when I started to realize that, okay, so I have a personal story, as if I go to make a picture book or if I go to make a podcast. Most of my podcasts have stories in them. I do a lot of public speaking is a big part of what I do. And that always incorporates stories and analogies and metaphors and that kind of thing. That when I fell in love with public speaking and podcasting, it was because of that. And what happened was I became obsessed with analogy and kind of story as allegory, of kind of like proof of a point. It's almost like you put all these pieces together and you say, let's let this play out. And if it plays out towards what I'm trying to say, the audience will have a experience of whether that's true or not. And so, you know, we've all seen the kind of propaganda where they're trying to prove a point with all these pieces, but it's not adding up.
Right,
and we're rejecting it because we're like, the character wouldn't do that, or that wouldn't happen, or what. And so I kind of got obsessed with a story as analogy or allegory, and kind of the power of how it reminds us of true things in a way that we feel. Not in a way that we think, but it's just like, you know, how many things we all know we should be present, But then we see those movies that really light that up. One of my favorite, it's a little bit of a guilty pleasure, but I just think it's so good in terms of story, is About Time. If you watch About Time, you're just gonna have you. Oh, I recommend it. It's a good sob fest. It'll really, like, it gets me every time. And it just illustrates why you need to be present, why you don't want to miss things with the people you love. And, you know, we all have stories that do that for us. But I was already an illustrator, and then I started going down this path of public speaking, storytelling, and whatnot. And, you know, probably 4 years into that, I was listening to, I don't know if it was a TED talk, something of that nature. And this public speaker's talking, and they're like, hey, I'm just going to give you analogy to kind of tell you what I'm trying to say. Here's my illustration. And I was like, okay, they're the same thing. Like, that's, and I think because illustration and visual art, like the design world, which my degree's in graphic design, but I'm not really a designer. The design world has so much theory, and there's so much like good practices and debate around what is design, what's good design, da 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 da.
Yeah, I mean, you eventually get into aesthetics and everything, which is like as ancient of a philosophical conversation as there is.
Definitely. And illustration, I don't know if it's because it's such an introverted activity. I don't know if it's because it's such an intuitive thing, but there just seem to be a lot less. There is some, but there's a lot less around what is this? What are we trying to do with this? And I think just the lack of philosophy that I could find and dig my teeth into, I just started to feel uninterested in it. And then this stumbled upon this definition of illustration, which is writing with pictures. That mixed with realizing like, oh, analogies, metaphors are illustrations. And then going into symbol and archetype and dream symbol. You know, if you listen to a really good dream interpretation, you're gonna start hearing how the words they're using for the literal and the words they're using for the metaphorical are going to be the same words. And then as you're like developing stories and analogies, the closer you can get, I've heard it said this way, a different way. One of my favorite designers, his name's Frank Camaro. He said, if you're looking for an analogy, you're trying to find different nouns that share the same verb. And it's just like that, a robot and a human, two different nouns, but they can both defy their programming. So the defying the programming gives that tissue, but it can be, you know, just like we did with the astronaut thing, like shooting for the stars. We can do that whether we're in a space shuttle as that noun or just as a person, like metaphorically. So I just started to see the richness and the opportunity and the power that illustration really is, the animating force behind a story's ability to move you, because you have to really select it well to pair with the point you're trying to make. And then even beyond that, you're selecting it. You know, one of the, like, I just watched with my kids yesterday, the new Ninja Turtles movie, and I really liked it. I heard it's really good.
Yeah.
It was really great. But I was thinking about how, in terms of storytelling, I think it's as strong as something like Spider-Verse.
Wow.
But it doesn't use an illustration that is an archetype that's captured the consciousness of the culture same way that the multiverse has. To me, underneath it, the points are as good as each other. They're these human powerful truths that we need to feel, you know, whichever they're respectively different points, but they're the same kind of thing. But the illustration that they chose, one just has this psychic power, the psychic charge that the other one maybe doesn't. And so that field of choosing archetypes, understanding symbols, finding the truths or the ideas that you want to illustrate and then finding the perfect way to illustrate that thing. I'll tell you a dumb example, but again, it's just kind of an example.
Yeah.
Now, when I make episode art for my podcast every week, and one of my recent favorites was I wanted to illustrate the idea, listen to yourself. And I started going into the Book of Symbols, and I'm trying to find stuff around listening and hearing and that kind of thing. And I end up stumbling upon the shell and it being, you know, listening to a shell here in the ocean. And so then I created the ocean as a character listening to a shell, and now it's listening to itself. Mm-hmm, and so all those choices of playing with symbol and pairing them perfectly or as good as you can with the point you're trying to make to help illuminate because I think also illustration is a lot like acting. It's like you're taking a text and you're trying to make people feel it through archetypes, you know?
Right.
So I think, I don't know if that answers your question, but I came at it from a bunch of different angles.
I don't even remember what the question was anymore, but that's okay. We don't need to. It's open-ended riffing, and it's great stuff, man. Yeah.
Thanks.
I think the thing about archetypes that is so wild to me is when you start finding these parallels across cultures, because one of the things that struck me when you were talking is that a good story is like an anamnesis. It is like a discovery of innate knowledge that you already knew. It's something that you feel in your psyche. And when I say psyche, I'm going for the Greek definition of both mind and soul, where it's clicks. It's that subjective clicking. It's like, no one needs to explain it to you. This makes sense. It's like when a mathematical equation clicks, it's like when a geometrical proof clicks, but way more just subjective, I guess. You know, it's the subjective version of that. Yes, this adds up. Yes, this makes sense. No one needs to explain it to me. It's like a well-formed formula of innate human and cultural and symbolic and psychological knowledge or something. And that in and of itself is really mind-blowing when you try to take apart what that means and how that web of intelligence and knowledge works. It's just mind blowing. And that's one of the things that keeps me convinced or highly suspicious that this realm of psyche is a real thing, and that we can all independently come to these conclusions without, you know, having anyone explain things to us. And the more basic level you take this down to, the more interesting it gets. And this starts to lead back into that third thing that you said you wanted to come back to is like, yeah, we can understand conceptually there's stuff out here. Most cognitive scientists and people studying it don't think the way we perceive the world's really how it is, but nonetheless, there's stuff, right? There's stuff. Yeah. We can weigh it, measure it, whatever. Seems to be out there. Then we can get behind this notion. We have this subjective experience of stuff is happening, psychical. Is that a separate world? Is that a connected world? Is it just connected in some way we don't understand? But then the third question is sensibility in and of itself and where the components for sense making come from. Number, basic geometry, these things. This obviously goes back to Platonism. This goes back to Pythagoreanism. But even contemporary thinkers who are at the tip of the spear of physics and mathematics, like Roger Penrose, they think about the world in this way of this, like this triune world of essentially, you know, the stuff we can measure, the mental, like, or not even the stuff that we can measure, but the world out there, really, the mental world in there. And then the fact that we have number and we have this realm of a priori sense making ability where 1 + 1 = 2 before a human mind thought it, you know, a triangle was a triangle before the human mind thought it. Also just thought provoking things like, why does every culture know what all the basic Platonic solids are and basic shapes are, yet those things don't exist out there in the woods or, you know, wherever, but we all know about it. We all draw it. We all just are like, yeah, it's a circle. Yeah, it's a triangle. Yeah, it's a square. So I don't even know where I'm going with that, but I just felt like going there because it felt, it felt relevant to what you were saying. But I think when you combine those three things, I guess this is my point, is that it makes that weird sense making that we have the capability to do make some level of sense. It makes that ability of, yes, this story works because it's tapping into something that we're already connected to. And I think that's what myths have always done. And I think that's why human beings have been almost somehow coerced into making myths and repeating myths over and over. Mm. Tell me if you feel this way, but I can't explain personally why I feel compelled to do some of the creative things that I do, but I just am. And it's almost as if there's some kind of, you know, it's not physiological. I can't link it to like my drives for hunger or for reproduction or whatever, but it feels just as, I got to do this, you know, I got to get this out. I got to, and what is that, you know, and it kind of explains that in a way too.
Yeah, it does. And I think I had two competing, first of all, I love the riff on that third thing. And I see a parallel of this idea between
Before I forget, I wanted to say too, that, so we could think of that as the Platonic realm of forms or the realm of the collective unconscious and archetypes. And Jung himself did link those two ideas, which was a great, like, ooh, for me when I read that. So I wanted to get that in there too.
Yeah. And are we saying, you know, like the, I don't know why it's escaped me, just the thing that he was obsessed with the mandalas and and circles and all the, you're saying like the basic things all the way up to kind of archetypal things. I see a parallel there where I wonder if, what was the word you used at the start? I didn't know it, but it was the thing of prior knowledge.
Like, anamnesis or anamnesis, however it's pronounced. Yeah. It's just like the Greek word for, instead of acquiring knowledge out there empirically, like I know this because I measured it and I, you know, have reproduced it in various experiments or whatever. It's just something, you know, and there's some famous, but admittedly, like you can poke holes or argue against, but there's some famous examples of this from some Platonic dialogues of like, there's one where Socrates is getting a boy to solve a basic geometric proof without, you know, he's not feeding him the answer. He's giving him the setups and the kid's figuring it out himself. And they're using that as an example of like, even this kid knows this stuff and he's not educated yet.
Yeah. And that idea, it was Plato was into that, right? Like idea that we're just like remembering and all the knowledge is already within us, that kind of idea. I think that's really, it's a cool idea. And like you said, I think there's a lot of ways you can kind of just dismantle that or think of it just a different way. But as you were saying that about with story, I almost feel like stories, it's almost like, where I think we're trying to like tell better and better stories that get closer and closer to true. And we have something that recognizes where we're trying to go or something like that. Like even as I was watching Ninja Turtles yesterday, which I love kids' movies that are good because often, you know, in order to be good, they have to be at the core, a good story.
Right.
And it's classic storytelling too. And even though I really liked it, I felt there was something where I was like, you know, I think the stories that are going to prove out, like the thing about this that feels unable to go past this Ninja Turtle creation from the 80s is that it's based on violence. And I look, I like I said, I love Elden Ring. I love playing, you know, I love the combat. I can get into it just like anybody else, but I can feel that one part of me being like, yeah, this story is going to have to evolve because I think we're trying to figure out a way forward without violence. I think consciousness wants to, you know, wants to go that way. But yeah, that's kind of what it was kind of churning up for me. But what were you, I can't remember what the actual question was, but I was, Or what was the last thing you said?
Oh, I guess I'll just spin it into a new question.
Yeah.
I kind of was asking this before. I think we went a slightly, this was my question a while back when I was like, I don't remember what the question was anyway.
Yeah.
Was the professional creativity versus the personal creative sort of catharsis, and the, how you actually delineate between those two things? And is there like a personal, almost meditative, or maybe to put it into Jungian depth psychology, analytical psychology terms, almost like an active imagination type thing that you do, where, because, you know, like in the Red Book, for instance, a lot of this stuff, a lot of the art in the Red Book was Jung going through various endogenous thought experiments, basically, where he would kind of get himself into a, almost like a trance state. Mm-hmm. Until he felt like he wasn't driving anymore and characters were emerging and he would converse with the characters. And it was almost like, it was pretty much like dreams that he was having while conscious enough to capture them, write them down, recreate them in art and images and stuff like that. Has your practice gotten as deep as going in that direction?
I mean, that's the kind of statement that I feel an audience or somebody after you has to determine. I don't know if it has felt that way at times. And I have some very, I kind of, probably the most core property idea, you know, thing in my creative practice is this thing called Invisible Things, which I made a picture book with my wife, and we published it over the summer. And that really was birthed from practicing active imagination when I didn't really fully understand what that was. And I'll tell you how I kind of stumbled into that in just a second. But before I go there, I think it's a great question to wrestle with as a creator. And I love the way you framed it, of the personal and the professional. You know, I grew up as a dude from the Midwest, and I didn't grow up in culture. I grew up in a very like traditional place, and I was raised by, you know, my mom is an artist and a kind of trying to find an acceptable term
for free spirit, maybe.
Yeah. trying to be gentle with it.
Right.
And you know, she was an addict, and she is kind of a mess in a whole bunch of ways, but I didn't grow up around her. And I grew up with my dad and my stepmom, and they both are, you know, corporate America, fully bought into the whole thing. And so I think initially, as I got started choosing a career, going into design and illustration, I didn't really, this kind of worked for me for a while, but I didn't see a difference between the personal and the professional. I didn't see, like, I was just raised on pop culture. So the art that I had, it was all commercial. So I didn't really make that distinction. And I think for the first leg of my journey, that served me, because I didn't, the ways I might have been compromising, I didn't know I was, or whatever. It took me a long time to kind of get to a place where I do see those two things as distinctly different. I see them as kind of as different as the deep self and the ego.
Right.
But the whole point being that they work together, that, you know, and that goes back to that thing of the deep self, the personal stuff, the stuff that is trying, feels like it's an impulse to put into the universe, that I think of that part of me as blind to reality, doesn't really think about money, doesn't really know what the opportunities are. It's more just it's like an impulse from a, you know, deep space. And the ego side of me is just supposed to figure out how do I find the resources and make and apply this to the opportunity. Because, you know, when I was 13, my mom bought me a microphone, because she's like, she's like, I think you should be in radio. And of course, like, that's how I think about the deep self, is like, I think you need to be talking on radio. Mm-hmm. And you're like, the radio, it's called podcasting now, Mom. Like, you know, it's that kind of like, you have to interpret it. And so now I see it more as like a tension of opposites thing of you can't do both at the same time. It's kind of, I think that creative personal side and that business minded or career minded or practical minded side, I think it's very much like that. You can't write and edit. You can't be in both brain waves at the same time, and you have to pulse back and forth. And so when I first started in my practice, I really just didn't, I went to college and I didn't, it was a really open experience, not a lot of guidance where I went, which was cool. Like, you know, there was a lot of good things about that. But ultimately I was like, look, in a couple of years, I'm going to have to do this as a career. So I was just like panicking. And I just really just started making work that was trendy. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's a phase for a lot of people. And also it's a phase for most creators. You've got to go through the imitation phase where you're just kind of, you know, learning from your heroes and that kind of thing. But once I got out of college and that those trends that I was a part of kind of dried up, I was back at square one in a way, and I didn't have any substance built below that. And I think it wasn't until that time that I realized, like, I'm going to have to do work that has no commercial viability. I'm going to have to separate these phases, and I'm going to have to go into a phase where I don't know what the point or use or commercial value is of the stuff that I'm exploring and making. And so I went into this process where I made a new character every weekday for a year. And this is kind of going back to how it was active imagination before I ever knew anything about Jungian thought or that idea whatever. And it came from an artist who I was a huge fan of that essentially was taking a psychoanalytic approach to reading a story where you're saying like all these characters are just part of the same psyche, but you can also take a psychoanalytic approach to creating. And that's what I stumbled into. In that time, I was just desperately like consuming every interview I could from all my favorite creators and just studying the work. And one of my favorites is Charles Schulz, who made Peanuts and Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
And he said something that just really lit me on fire. He said that, you know, his name is Charles. He's Charlie. So all the time people would ask him, like, are you Charlie Brown? Like, is this just autobiographical? Which is funny too, because Charlie Brown's such a loser and he's depressed and all that. And I loved him. I mean, I really related to him. So I'm not dissing him. But Charles Schulz would say, yes, but all of them are me. So Snoopy is the part that I wish I was. Lucy is my sarcastic kind of cunning side.
Right.
Lionel's my spiritual side and so on. And I was so fascinated. I didn't know that how that connected to Jungian thought or anything, but I was like, I think I'm going to do that. And so I did this project where I did a new character every weekday for a year, and some of them were inspired by other people I know, but most of them were just trying to take one aspect of myself and get it out of my head and get it onto a page in the form of a character. And then those characters, they're really exploring the kind of hidden world archetype. Like I think about it like my favorite version is, there's Alice in Wonderland and Wizard of Oz and all that.
Okay. But,
my favorite is Link to the Past, Zelda, the Super Nintendo one. I didn't know at the time, but I was like wrestling with hidden realms, and all the characters were kind of hiding. And then it eventually evolved into this thing called Invisible Things, but that all came from that.
Yeah. That's such a rich archetype right there. The hidden realm that's just there beyond our perception. I have real early memories of imagining hidden doorways in my house and like thinking like, oh, I don't know, man, just the weird, some of that weird stuff that you just, think about when you're a kid or you dream about when you're a kid, and you don't understand that there's just this rich, endless tradition of that exact same idea.
Yes.
And there's some just great quotes too. Like Heraclitus has a, like from Heraclitus's fragments, the pre-Socratic philosopher, he calls, I don't remember if he's saying it about nature or the mystery, but he means like the numinous realm, right? The noetic realm. He calls it a self-hiding mystery. And I love this idea of it being of like the deeper layers of reality. They just, they hide themselves for some reason, but you can find ways to either inductively sniff them out or you can discover them somehow. And I definitely think tapping into what we would call the quote unquote imagination is one of the ways those hidden things start to show themselves. And it's so hard, and I'm kind of having a micro epiphany right now, that it's so hard to, if you say this is a self-hiding thing, well, what does that imply? It implies I don't know what it looks like, right? So that then, so then you start freestyling with the imagination of like, I like, what are these, like, I sense that it feels like this, it feels like this, maybe more like this. And you're just, again, you're riffing with your subconscious, with the collective unconscious, with whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And something comes out, and something comes out that can, if you're a good artist, faithfully capture an element of that hidden thing. And it's remarkable because for the same reasons that that innate knowledge works, that anamnesis works, other people point at them like, yeah, that, I get it. You're speaking to something. You're speaking to something that I get. And what is that? I get, you know, quote unquote, I get.
It's my gosh.
Yeah.
I love that. What were we going to say?
No, I mean, it's just yet another example of something that we're not saying anything to say, I get it.
Yeah.
But you understand what it means. That person understands something. Yeah.
I feel like the artist creative impulse is that it's almost like a Koan kind of thing.
Yeah.
The impulse is wanting to codify the I get it, wanting to explain it, wanting to be like, this is what it is, but you can never get there. Like, if you're a consumer of creative stuff, and I think it, like, to some degree, and there's a huge spectrum and it could mean a lot of things, that we're all creative people. That's humanity. That's one of the things about being a human. But I do think I've heard Beth Pickens, who is a creative therapist, basically. She says that the difference between an artist and a regular person, because we're all creative, is that the artist has to do it. Like, on a mental level, they're going to get sick if they don't do it. And I think that's almost that impulse of you're consuming, you're like, oh, I get it. Yes, I can vibe with that. And then a creator is like, I get it. And I want to critique it. And I'm like, it's not, I get it, but it's all like, let's try again to get even closer to it. But I love that self-hiding quote. I'm going to dive deep into that after this, because one of the symbol things that a lot of the characters have in common, there's a lot of threads that go through them, but one of them is that a lot of the characters are hiding. So they're either hiding in a cardboard box or under an umbrella, and you can just see like the eyes or a cloud or whatever. Like, half of them is hiding, and it's trying to use symbolism to get at, like, these are all things in the invisible world. They're all things that are self-hiding. And man, that really strikes me. I'm going to be chewing on it for a long time.
Have you formed an opinion on, like, ontologically what you associate that other world with? Or, I mean, it sounds like you're very open to the idea of that. It really is this realm. It's not just a function of the brain or something that we've made up, but it's got some kind of a priori existence of a human brain. Is that where you land, or do you just not care about landing? And that's just the idea.
I think, like, honestly, I don't, I think the best way to describe it would be I don't care to land.
Right.
But yeah. I do really care to explore. And I, right. so I don't have, I think growing up in the Midwest where everybody has very staunch religious opinions yeah. about, I, at some point in my early 20s, I think I just felt like essentially the way everyone's practicing spirituality is as if the purpose of being here is a fact-finding mission. Like those self-hiding things, the purpose is to nail them down, get them right. And when you right. die, you're going to be given a Scantron. And if you get the right answers, you yeah, get yeah, to yeah. go into the good place.
Right, right, right.
And I think when I would try to pray or meditate or connect with whatever the goodness of the universe is, I just never felt that that thing was would ever give me a Scantron like no, that. There was agreed. Just never like if I was like it just didn't seem like what we're doing here, you know. But I don't. But I love. I you know even like when Mormons would come around, you know, and knock on your door. I think I always just had a thing of like, come in. I want to hear this. I love hearing.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Love hearing all of the ideas about mm-hmm. Mormonism mm-hmm. and the lore and all of it. I'm not going to adopt it, but I'm into it. I will even find like interesting truth in that. But I also sure. find it interesting. Like I want to dive deeper into, I just heard about, the kind, I think it was Celtic, their version of that space. And I yeah. can't remember what it's called, but
like the druidic kind of thing.
Maybe it's the imagination. It's imaginary space that really exists okay. where all these things kind of live and, right. And have, yeah. Like have yeah, desires and stuff yeah. like that.
Yeah. I'm very much in this place where I'm looking for a way that feels authentic for me to try to start directly playing more in that place. And there's different ways to do it. And all of them feel aesthetically kind of foreign to me in a way where I'm like, I'm not ready to go drawing magic circles and like doing rituals and, you know, trying to, you know, do these various things, these like graduated things. But I find it very interesting. Like I find the proposition of that interesting, but in practice, like the idea of like walking around saying these words, drawing pentagrams and going, ha, and stuff like that. It's just not, it doesn't feel like my thing. And maybe it's just one of those yeah. humps you have to get over. I don't know, but it's, but I do feel the need to play in that space. And I think doing quote unquote mundane things can be a way to do that if they're somewhat wrapped in ritual. I think you have mm-hmm. to have yeah. some kind of ritualistic demarcation of I am going into the other place now. And I think active imagination is probably the closest thing that feels okay and stripped down of culture and weirdness enough to feel like I want to start doing that more often. Like I've done some active imagination meditations and stuff and it's interesting, but I've never yeah. gotten to the point where I really feel like I'm not driving. And this thing is without the advent of significant pharmacological perturbation of my consciousness. So, which I think is another very valuable, powerful path, but yeah, I do feel like I need a way to start entering that space more reliably, more often. And that might yeah. be the way that I go is with active imagination. But does your creative practice feel like you're consistently getting to a place like that? Or is it one of the things, because I find this a lot too, where I look back on things and I see things that I didn't even consciously like, oh man, this is totally this. And I made a shirt a long time ago for like a Third Eye Drop shirt. And it was before I got really into some of these conversations we've been having about like fate and understanding the sort of mythological roots of what fate is and the myth of Ur from Plato's Republic and all of these things that like describe exactly how like a soul or a person gets a fate and all these things.
Yeah.
And then I went back and looked at that shirt and I was like, holy shit, There's a lot of layers of this thing that I wasn't even thinking about that fit perfectly with that. Yeah. So that's one element that's sort of like, I don't know what I'm doing in the moment. And then I look back and see deeper layers. But then there's also the hands off, the muse is driving and I'm just kind of like a puppet for the muse. Can you reliably hit that, or is it?
I mean, again, like it's one of those things where maybe in retrospect, I'll be able to, I feel like I'm, that's what I'm trying to do. I think that I think there's a few different things that have become ritual for me that maybe it's a different way than we see in organized religion most of the time.
Yeah.
I make a podcast every week and I make a lot, I would say about 2/3 are just me solo. And I make an illustration every week for every episode. And that process is, and it's really the mechanics of a story, at least the way I think about story. And so the way that that manifests as a practice in active imagination or kind of essentially like daydreaming and interpreting it is that every story for me starts with some surprising truth, I would say. That's probably the best way I could say it. I think classic stories, that's kind of what they do. They're a three-part proof that acts in a very particular mathematical kind of way, I think. Yeah. And there's lots of really good, you know, deconstructions of that that I'm a fan of too. But I think that there's always a, in the same way for me, one practice I do a lot. So every day I take like an hour long bath. Every morning I do that. And I, that's almost, it's like that's my real religion over story is bath time. And
I want to throw this in here real quick because there's some really interesting stuff that I've just started finding out about that has to do with oracles and ancient forms of entering altered states where you have to submerge the body in sacred waters. And like somehow like the notion of you're becoming almost more of an antenna by submerging yourself in water for whatever that is. That's actually a really well established thing. And there's places, you know, if you get into the lore, there's places where supposedly, you know, mancy people with mancy, like there's different, you know, like geomancy, like different divination abilities. Yeah. They would find a water source and be like, this is sacred water. You need to build a temple here. And apparently like the temple of Delphi and Apollo, and there's a bunch of Egyptian ones I've heard of too. I just wanted to get that out there because there might be some interesting parallels with that.
And even, you know, lords in the Catholic tradition, there's a lot of places and these other traditions too, where they have these relationships to water. But I think even at the, like I totally track with that. And then I also track with the physical of just sensory deprivation, just like that. That's just the thing. And also just like water. I've also heard, like Andrew Garfield talking about, I think it was on Mark Maron's show, stepping into the ocean and just feeling like they had a message. And I was like, that's happened to me, that exact thing. And I thought, so I, look, I could get really weird with it, or I could be totally physical. Like, it's just all your stuff, you know, what I don't care, but that's what I do every day. And I'm always, it usually starts with, I just started integrating a gratitude practice into it. That's been a lifesaver because I am, that's my biggest problem is my ability to complain and see what's missing. It's a creative impulse of like, I want to bring something new, but I need to like, be like, what's here, what's good. But it usually starts with me reviewing my dream and just seeing if there's anything, the way I think about dreams. Yes. Again, like I said, I can get really weird with it. And sometimes they do feel like messages from another realm. But at the very least, I know that it gives me a real grounded perspective beyond my persona of what am I worried about? What am I wrestling with? What's really happening emotion mm-hmm. on an emotional level? And so I use some of those Jungian tools to try to like get that out. And then if I come across an idea that has that libido, that enthusiasm, mm-hmm. that it's like really, psychically charged.
Yeah.
That's what becomes a podcast episode. Mm. And then also becomes the illustration, which again is me reaching for symbol, reaching for an archetype or language. And so I do think that has become a very real ritual practice of that for me.
Yes. Yes.
And I've been doing the podcast for almost 10 years, like 9 years or something.
Wow.
So it's
for a second, I thought you were going to say, I've been doing the podcast from the bath. And I was like, oh, that sounds like that like something someone would do.
Except for you might kill yourself on accident.
Yeah. You got to get the technology right.
Yeah.
Some waterproof mics or something. that registers a lot. And I think that really speaks to something I've experienced and I'm sure everybody out there can relate to, which is you can't force creativity. It's one of these paradoxical relationships, because I very much love the war of art mentality of
sure.
the muse.
Yeah, me too.
The muse loves,
and,
yeah, the yeah. muse loves a blue collar worker. She loves sure, it when you yeah. get your ass, yeah, yeah, ass yeah. in the seat and you work. But there's also something to what you hear artists say time and time again, which is that you can't force it and you have to let it come to you. And I think to let it quote unquote come to you, you have to be in a sort of hands-off mental state where you're just sort of slowing down, meditative, relaxed. And then that's when just something pops in. And again, so many parallels to this in the ancient world with practices like incubation, with, like I said, the thing about oracles supposedly submerging in water and stuff like that. This is really well-established stuff. And I think now we probably could use more pinpoint language in terms of brain states and whatever, but I still think that's only like one dimensional slice what's really probably going on in terms of the psyche and the invisible and all these other things. On that note, man, I just want to throw this into the conversation because I thought it was so interesting and so many people are obviously a fan of him. Is I saw this riff recently from Andrew Huberman, the super famous neuroscientist, where he admitted that he has started praying. And I was like, whoa, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
And it's for all the reasons we're talking about. It's that I've acquired all this knowledge. I still feel like I need help. I still feel like I need inspiration. I still feel like I don't know shit. And I need to just kind of prostrate myself before the mystery and be like, help me, you know, help me get, inspire me. Like, you know, and that hit me hard. And also think of like, there's a lot of bravery involved in that too, because he's part of that hardcore academic mainstream that are immediately going to be like, are you kidding me? Come on, man. Like,
yeah.
You pray, you know,
materialism kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I really loved
that's great.
Loved hearing that. And he looked vulnerable talking about it. Like he looked a little choked up at times and like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I pray every day, you know, I pray for a good, maybe like a half hour every day type of thing where I just kind of open myself up and just ask for help and reflect and meditate and stuff like that.
I love that. And I actually think more creative people could use to do that, because it's something that just occurred to me that I don't know the science behind it, but what it triggered in my head was I've thought a lot about, some people call it the open versus the closed mode, and the closed mode being your editing brain, mm-hmm. you know, and the open mode, praying is a very open mode because you're literally opening yourself up. You're saying, I can't do this on my own. You're really asking for the inspiration. Like, I think that is a ritual in its own right prior to creative acts. Yeah. Like that makes tons of sense. The other thing I wanted to just say was, I imagine that you doing this show has a lot of parallels to what I was describing in the active imagination cycle of diving into the unconscious, seeing what thing kind of bubbles up as like, this is the thing I want to explore next. And then having the ritual of creating an episode about it has become kind of a spiritual practice for me. And then I thought that has to be similar to you in terms of who you interview, what little diversions you go into. It's probably, that's why I think a creative habit has so much to give and so much in common with spiritual ritual, you know?
Definitely. Yeah. And there's a progression to it. You know, even if you only do the exercise, like you said, of I'm doing a character every day or week or whatever it was. And it's the same thing. I'm doing a podcast. I'm putting something out every day, every week. There's this psychical progression you're committing to. There's this, you know, like you, to your point, the cycle of idea cycling and I don't like this and whatever, I'm going to try it again and not, okay, it's got to be good enough. It's got to be good enough now. And you have to, just going through that, I think, is an immensely important process for understanding your mind, sculpting your mind. It's some kind of like weird fit, like psychical fitness that I don't think is talked about. You know, think about the perpetually pregnant creative people who are like, always have an idea, never do anything. Always have an idea, never do anything. You got to get over that. I mean, you got to get over that. And I get it because I used to play in bands too. And I wanted to write epic songs. I wanted to write stuff that was pulling from all this stuff. I wanted to write like the equivalent to like Homer's Odyssey or something in musical form and just like hidden layers of esoteric meaning and stuff. But you got to get through those progressions of like finishing stuff. It's done now. It's done now. And that's where things can really start to flow and open up. Cause I'm not going to presume to speak for the muse, but I know she don't like a guy who walks around pregnant with an idea for 5 years.
She's true. Like,
no, thanks. I'll move on to someone who's actually going to hit 100%. The publish button or whatever. So I'm definitely with you. It's definitely a thing. Yeah. And there's all these weird stages. I'm in a place where, you know, although we have some key differences, cause I don't have kids. Sure. So, you know, I'm sure your day has to be a lot more structured than mine.
Yeah, true.
I have a lot of mental wandering. I feel like I do, where I'm just sort of in the, you know, it's funny because you're talking about being open versus closed. And the immediate phrase that came to my mind is, man, my spiritual orifice is open a lot of the time. It's just like, something come to me, you know, just please, like whatever that signal of just like longing, of just like stewing in my longing. I do that shit a lot. And it's kind of embarrassing. I think if that's directed, it's great. But I think if it's just like self stewing, it gets very sort of just tragic and gross or something, but at least I'm doing it in the privacy of my own home or behind a microphone in front of thousands of people, whichever. Yeah. But, but yeah, man, I'm with you. It's definitely a progression and I consider it to be sacred. And I don't think it matters whether, you know, everybody out there thinks it is or rolls their eyes at that idea or whatever. Mm-hmm. I definitely think there's absolutely something valuable about doing it. Yeah. And it's another one of those things that's like an archetype. It's the birth of the idea, the imperfect rendering of the pure idea, and then the even more imperfect final draft that you're like, I guess it's done, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's another example of that fractal, of that infinite fractal coming from nowhere, from the self-hidden place, I think.
And that process, it makes sense where as you progress in your craft, the impulse that's maybe coming from a perfect place and your ability to really create what you had in your head, like that gets closer and closer and you get more of an overlap. But if you don't act on it, you don't get any closer. And one of the things about that's what's so interesting, I think, about the idea of a story as a kind of proof of some kind.
Yeah.
Is that until you put all the characters down on the page and you work it out, you don't really have a full sense of, did this prove it? You know, when I was in one of my early books trying to put it together, the end of the story ended up being something that at the time I would have disagreed with, but it couldn't end any other way. And so I was like, okay, well, I guess I have to change my beliefs now, because this, that I put all the pieces down and almost more as a question, and the answer that came through challenged how I saw the world. And so that was the act of, I think, putting it into onto the canvas and making it so I could see it. That's where active imagination, I think, makes sense, of not just keeping it in your head, or at least speaking it, if not drawing it or writing it. But I think that's the thing of morning pages, even, of like, you have all these things stewing and in your head, and it's just, and it's just like you said, this, you have this, I get in that same state, and you're right. Kids, I think commitments are a good counterbalance to that open mode, because they force you into action. Mm-hmm. And that's what a habit is too. Like, the habit of doing an episode forces me to be like, get out of the bath, quit trying to. And I also think about it, like, I've said it like this, like, I feel like God or the universe or whatever this thing is that's, you know, giving you this stuff. Often am I seeking, because I'm such a seeker, just like you were describing, exactly the same. You know, every day I'm like, all right, what's the new, like, come on. Like, and I feel like often the answer I get is, you can't have seconds if you don't finish your plate. Like, finish this. I told you something 3 years ago. You're still working on it. Do that thing. Get to the end of it. Learn what you got to learn. And then the next thing will happen, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That might be a great closing thought, man. I love that. I love that. And this has been so much fun. We could definitely revisit this many times, I think. And you're definitely welcome to come back.
Thank you.
Before we do though, where do you want to point people? What do you have burning in your pocket at the moment?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks. I love this. It was very cathartic to talk to somebody with such a similar open seeking state. So it was very,
and I didn't even
enjoyable.
Say, I didn't even say this too, but I grew up in the Midwest too. So we have,
oh, you did? Of that in common. Where are you from?
Appleton, Wisconsin.
Okay. So, I'm from near Indiana.
Okay.
Yeah. So I have a new kid's book called Invisible Things. That's a product of a bunch of stuff we were talking about. It is a kid's book, but it kind of accidentally, a lot of the reviews talk about it being kind of a guided meditation, and it is that. And there actually are things injected into that, like exercises that we did on purpose, but I didn't think of it like that because I'm ADHD. I have all this energy. Meditation is a challenge for me, but it's, that book is me taking all the hidden worlds of Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz, and all that. And it's kind of it's a tribute to when I was 17 and I realized like those hidden worlds are real in terms of quantum physics and just the sensory other things you can't see. Like National Geographic says 97% of the universe is invisible. So it's about that. It's about how magic our world is. So that's it. And I also have a podcast called Creative Pep Talk, which I do every week.
Beautiful, man. Yeah. Well, let's do this again for sure. Lots of fun. I agree, man. It's cathartic to talk to you too, because even though I have these kinds of conversations more, it's still like people that I really feel like are at a similar point on the time space mysterium tremendum, whatever the f*** going on, is still very rare. And I feel like you're one of those, man. So this is,
it's rare that you're in the same neighborhood. Like, you're like, wait, and we have some different maps and stuff. It's great.
Yeah, man. All right. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you. Massive shout out to Michael Phillip for having me on your podcast and interviewing me and bringing some great questions my way. Really had a blast. Like I said, if this kind of thing is interesting to you, go check out some of his episodes on Jung or Jung, as you should say. And I'm learning. I'm trying to get better at it. I'm trying to find a natural feeling around saying it and working that in, because it doesn't feel like my natural accent. But we'll figure it out over time. You can watch me awkwardly try to navigate those waters. But go check out Michael Phillip and his podcast, Third Eye Drops. I highly recommend the episode with Lisa Miller. That is just such a powerful episode and really helped me tap into that side of my psyche in a way that I haven't for a long time. So yeah, I recommend it. And thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music and our soundtrack. Thanks to Connor Jones of Pending Beautiful for editing the show and sound design. Massive shout out to Katie Chandler, Ryan Appleton, and of course Sophie Miller for content assistance of all kinds. And until we speak again, stay pepped up.